Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There has never been anything quite like ABC TV's hit drama Lost. Yes, there was The Twilight Zone, The X-Files, Planet of the Apes, and for that matter, Robinson Crusoe and Gilligan's Island. But for sheer mystery and complexity woven around island castaways, Lost sets the bar. And that's even before you add in the boiling web world of online Losties who have made their own mark on the series. Up next, On Point, we go inside the wild world of Lost with the show's executive producers, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, on the fate of Lost. Joining me now from Hollywood are the award-winning executive producers of Lost, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. Lindelof was co-creator of the series with J.J. Abrams. With Cuse, he writes the show. He's written and produced for NBC's Crossing Jordan, CBS's Nash Bridges, and ABC's Wasteland. As if producing Lost weren't enough, he's now working on a new Star Trek movie slated to come out in 2008. Damon Lindelof, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Carlton Cuse helped develop Lethal Weapon 2 and 3 and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. He was executive producer of the critically acclaimed Fox series The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. and of Nash Bridges. He told TV critics this year it's now time to find an end point for Lost when some doubted it could ever be tied up with an end. Carlton Cuse, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So we know what you told the critics. Are you sticking by it? Is there going to be an end to this thing?
Yes, there will be an end. We're still discussing that with the network in terms of when that's going to happen, but Lost is a story. It has a beginning, middle, and end, and I think we owe it to our audience to tell them that there is going to be an end and when that end is going to be.
Damon, did you know the beginning, middle, and end at the outset, or were you just diving on to a new frontier here?
We knew the beginning and the end. The middle was the challenge, as it is in life, I suppose. Especially when, if you know Act One and Act Three, Act Two becomes sort of a pronounced and an exciting and ongoing tap dance, which is sort of our daily existence. But we did know, where we wanted to end up.
Lots of new things associated with Lost, but among them, Carlton, this idea that there's going to be an end to a TV series that's part of its narrative. I mean, typically that comes from the numbers, you know. When it stops producing, you produce an end. Are we going to see this now, sort of shows that are built around a single narrative that has an arc, beginning, middle, and end? Is that the future, or is Lost a one-off?
I think it will be a combination of the two things. I think there sort of are two categories of series. One is sort of a franchise based series, and the other is a story-based series. And Lost is a story-based series. It postulates an idea that really needs resolution. A bunch of people are standing on an island. The island is very mysterious, and we basically, as an audience, want to know what is their fate ultimately. Are they going to get off the island? What is the nature of the mysteries of this island? And those are questions that the end of the series has to answer. If you're doing a show like Grey's Anatomy, it's a franchise. It's a condition. There's always going to be new doctors and new patients cycling into that hospital, and it can go on basically for as long as the audience is interested in watching the show.
I guess that's part of the issue, Damon. There's been this. You described the middle as being where you tap dance, and I'm curious as producers how you look at that. You're getting feedback directly.
He breakdances. He doesn't tap dance.
He's a man.
I've got my cardboard out right
okay.
now.
But you get it from the web. You get it in the numbers, the audience numbers. You no doubt get it directly. But you had real decisions to make about how long you could keep these plates spinning, these many thickly woven narrative strands here. If you knew the beginning and the end, you probably didn't know how long you could go in the middle. How do you decide when to start to turn the corner and take it toward that conclusion, which Carlton says you're now on whatever pace headed toward?
You know, those conversations reached sort of critical mass this year as we began to, move over the proverbial hump of, you know, there were all these stories that we knew that we were going to do going into the show that we started setting up in the first several episodes. You know, the idea that there were other people on the island. Now we've spent the majority of the third season sort of spending time with those people, learning more about them and sort of getting into why they've been doing what they've been doing. And once that sort of, you know, that's the last sort of big fundamental island mystery that is sort of, you know, coming to light. Once that is resolved, you're sort of heading for, you know, the finish line in a lot of ways. So our conversations with the network and studio and obviously the public discourse, this isn't something that we've been driving towards. As Carlton, I think, astutely pointed out, the audience has sensed that this is a story-based series from the beginning, and we're not the first show to be that. The Fugitive is actually sort of a perfect model. I can't name the exact number of episodes, but I know that it ran for 5 seasons and that it ended at the top of its game with huge ratings. And Richard Kimball caught the one-armed man because that's what that was what the show was about. So this dialogue has been going on from the very beginning, and we find ourselves blessed to be with a network and a studio, Steve McPherson and Mark Pedowitz at ABC and Touchstone, respectively, who sort of understood this and have been talking with us since the inception of the show of saying, we don't, you know, tap dancing is very interesting to watch for a certain period of time, but we don't want you guys to do it forever either. And we acknowledge that this is a special show. We don't want it to go out with nobody watching it. So, you know, although the conversations are still ongoing, we've always been talking about an ending as opposed to whether or not there would be one.
A lot, so much has unfolded in this arc, and you've got legions of fans who've become Losties just, you know, 1 week to the next. Of course, it'll be on tonight, Wednesday night. But I wonder at the outset, Carlton Cuse, what was your ambition? Did you, and how much of what it became did you conceive from the very get-go in terms of its texture, its depth going down paths of philosophy and personal exploration and all the rest? What were your starting ambitions with this show?
Well, you know, just to recap a brief history, I was not involved at the very beginning of the show. The show was created by Damon and J.J. Abrams, and they made this spectacular pilot, and I came in a few episodes into the beginning of the conception of the series. And really, honestly, no one believed that the show had any future at all, and I think the expectation was that at best-case scenario, it was going to be 12 and out. And that was enormously liberating. It really gave us the opportunity to say, okay, let's just make a show that we think is really cool. Let's do all the things that we want to do and break a lot of rules of traditional drama. You know, there were sort of all these unwritten edicts in network television. You couldn't have a large and sprawling cast. You couldn't have characters sort of debating, you know, moral and ethical and philosophical issues. You couldn't have characters who were inherently unsympathetic. A bunch of our characters have literally murdered people. You know, you couldn't have complex serialized storytelling, which required a really heavy investment from the audience. And yet we did all of those things because I think there was a certain giddy liberation in the sense that the show was not going to have to endure for the long haul, but it was going to, you know, just be a fantastic, you know, hopefully, you know, something that burns bright and then dies. But then, so we started down that path, and it became really interesting and compelling as storytellers to start working out these stories. Then I remember the ratings for the pilot came in, and they were huge.
Over the top, 20 million, off we go.
We were terrified. We were like,
we're going to have to actually have to deliver. Do this for a long time now. And, you know, at that point, we really had to commit. And so once the pilot ratings came out, and then when the first week ratings after that were also equally large, it became clear that the show really did have, you know, an audience that was interested in watching it, and we really had to sort of kind of take the basic mythological tenets that we had and figure out, okay, how do we make these work for the long haul? And then we really began figuring out the mythology and the big, you know, all the big mythological roadmaps.
Those numbers now down a bit, and we'll talk about that. But Damon, you were there at the creation. How did you sell this? Did you sell it as the sort of gigantic ball of yarn that it became, or was there a sort of a, you know, an elevator pitch, the 30-second version? How do you sell a show like Lost in Hollywood in Burbank?
I never would have had the hubris to sell the Desert Island show. In fact, what happened was Lloyd Braun, who was the president of ABC at the time, had this idea for a couple years to do a show about a plane that crashed on an island. He wanted, as a fan of Survivor, the reality show on CBS, he just said, why can't we do that show as a drama? And he had been trying to sort of develop it for a couple of years mm-hmm. and was sort of widely ridiculed in the halls of ABC for trying to launch an untenable television show. And he basically went to JJ, who was the creator and executive producer of Alias at the time, and said, can you take this idea and make it work? And JJ said, I'm busy with 9 other things. They brought me in. I had been kind of stalking JJ for several years just as a huge fan of his. We had a 2-hour-long meeting, and we started talking about ways that we could potentially make a very, very cool pilot out of this. Whether there was a series was yet to be revealed, but the idea of sort of looking at it as a character-based drama with a flashback franchise where every week you would see a small story about one of these people sort of gradually leading them to the island. You were actually doing 2 shows. We thought that might be very, very cool. So that was kind of our pitch. And they were so excited, you know, just that anybody was willing to
give it a
take
shot.
A crack at this right. idea. You know, they kind of bought it in the room, and everything happened very quickly from that meeting between JJ and myself. 12 weeks later, we handed them the 2-hour finished, you know, pilot. So
right. Here is a little chat about destiny. All kinds of big themes come in here. Here's lost character John Locke, played by Terry O'Quinn, talking with Jack, played by Matthew Fox, about why they've landed on this island.
We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us.
And who brought us here, John?
The island. It's destiny.
I don't believe in destiny.
Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse join us from Hollywood, California. Damon, there you are. You've got a big hit on your hands. It's got a very wide-open kind of structure to it. And pretty soon you're off with fate and destiny and existential, you know, Kant and Rousseau and Hume. What, did you just go back and pull out all your old college textbooks and savage them for material? Or seriously, what were the source buckets that you ended up with and how?
I think, you know, first off, to project that basically Carlton and I are the only people writing the show is not entirely accurate. We are, you know, we are running the show, and sort of every script and story is going through, filtered through us. But we have a staff of amazing writers, all of whom who bring sort of distinct flavors. And, you know, along the way, you know, some of them were actually philosophy majors and mm-hmm. got to use that. But we started naming characters after philosophers sort of very early on, and that did kind of finally validate philosophy 101 as a, you know, that was a C worth getting back at my alma mater. So, you know, but it was more that we were really talking about these ideas of faith clashing with empiricism, and the idea of, you know, putting out there into the, you know, the actual story of the show and the lexicon of the show, this idea of, is this all arbitrary? Is it happening for a reason? Is there purpose? Or is it just, you know, 10 crazy writers in a room trying to pull an episode out of their heads every 8 days? That became the dialogue in the show between, you know, primarily these 2 characters, Jack and Locke.
And you know, and the show is really metaphorical. I mean, the title Lost is yep. obviously about the fact that they're on an island, but it really is much more significantly about how these characters are lost in their lives. And I think, you know, we all struggle in our lives to find meaning and purpose and answer that question of, you know, what do I do with my life and how does one lead a life? And we just sort of took that debate and we put it in the mouths of our characters. And Damon is Jewish. I'm Catholic. Mm. Issues of faith. Mm. Issues of destiny.
And guilt.
You flash back into many people's lives, and there's a lot to be guilty about here, as in all portions of life if you look at it that way.
Sure.
Exactly. What is there a cookbook? Was there? Is there? I mean, is there a ratio of philosophy lesson versus, you know, shoot 'em up drama, edge of your seat that you look to bring to each episode?
I think, you know, saying that there's a cookbook is sort of too empirical. I mean, we sort of do it by feel, and I think every episode is sort of like a recipe that you make that you sort of know intuitively you're going to put this much in and that much in, but you don't actually follow a prescribed measure of ingredients. And we basically, you know, certain episodes end up becoming, you know, sort of spicy mythology stews, and other ones become, you know, kind of character, you know, very character-based stories. And it sort of feels like each story kind of dictates how it's going to lay out. And as we start talking about, okay, this is going to be a Claire story, and It's going to be about, you know, how she sees these birds, and those birds all of a sudden activate a desire in her, a plan as to how she can get off the island. That becomes sort of a softer, more character-based episode. Other episodes are really heavy on the mythology, and we don't have a particular plan. We just try to sort of feel our way through each story in terms of what you know, what it should contain.
We have tried the cookbook approach on several occasions, but we find ourselves opening up the refrigerator and not finding the desired ingredients.
What's in there?
You say, how do we make macaroni and cheese without any cheese and no macaroni?
Do you look back? I mean, do you look to a kind of line of legacy? I don't know, Twilight Zone, X-Files, you name it. How do you think about precursors? Do they just generally inform you because they're part of our shared media history, or have you looked more specifically back?
Well, I think there's a lot of, you know, precursors, and I would think probably it tends to be more perhaps in literature than in television or movies, although I think there are many, many sort of shows that and things that have influenced us that we borrow from. I mean, most notably probably The Stand by Stephen King. I mean, Stephen King has been a huge influence. And when you look at sort of a long, sprawling, serialized tale with a beginning, middle, and end, The Stand is a great model because it's a, you know, it's a very high concept premise that is sort of a science fiction idea. A bunch of people get wiped out by a mysterious virus, and then they undertake a journey. But that is a 900-page journey, and that journey is very much about those characters and about their interactions with each other and an exploration of those characters along the way. And I think that, you know, it's a show that doesn't have a lot of antecedents, and that for us became a great model of how we could tell this story.
And Damon, the web piece of this absolutely exploded and began to feed back into the show itself. Describe for us how that happened. You helped it along. It also has a life of its own. What's that mix?
I think the web explosion was based on this sort of idea, this fundamental tenet of ours that, you know, we weren't going to tell you what the show was, you know, that it was going to present itself. And it's sort of, what do you think it is? Mm-hmm. You know, that idea of saying to the audience, your imagination now becomes a part of this show. You know, go talk about it with your friends. What, you know, what do you think is moving the trees? Where do you think the polar bear came from? Why do you think Locke can walk? You know, as opposed to traditional dramatic television, which basically says, here's a dead body in the first 5 minutes of the show. There's five guys standing over it, poking at it, looking at carpet fibers. And at the end of the hour, they basically tell you who killed that person and why.
And but it becomes so part of a show because it's in the blogosphere that surrounds the show, or have you actually reached out into the huge web conversation about Lost and pulled those elements into the narrative?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the reality is you know, we're writing the show, and by the time it becomes it's there for the audience to see, we're already sort of six episodes beyond there. You know, the train is already sort of moving. Where it becomes a really active conversation is between seasons. You know, most notably after the end of season one, we ended that season with our two main characters sort of looking down into a dark hatch, and the audience was outraged that we were ending the season there. How dare we make them wait for 4 months before they went in? And that sort of was a very clear signal to Carlton and I and the other writers that, you know, that we were going to sort of speed up the pace of mystery reveals going into the second season. And of course, that's sort of a slippery slope because, you know, you're moving between the two poles of the porridge is too hot and the porridge is too cold, but you're never really landing on just right. You're just kind of moving between the two.
And, of course, through the web, people really participating here. And, of course, this is one of those shows that very widely downloaded on the web. $1.99 at iTunes, and off you go. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, we have a ton of listeners who want to speak with you. I want to begin to turn to them. First from Nottingham, New Hampshire, Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a Lostie, or whatever the appropriate term is.
You're a fan.
I played the alternate reality game.
Describe that for us. What's the alternative reality game, Chris?
Over this past summer, I think it was, or I think that's when it was. It was
yes.
It was a game, if you will, on the web where a lot of secrets were actually revealed. And my question actually revolves around those secrets. Those of us who experienced the alternate reality game, those of us who participated, know what the numbers mean, those enigmatic numbers.
Lots of series of numbers here, yeah.
That's right. We know who Alvar Hanzo is. We know where he is. There are lots and lots of secrets. And what I expected was that early on in season three, those secrets were now then going to be revealed to the television audience. But that hasn't happened. And I followed the show, and I want it to be successful, even more successful than it is. We know it's a big hit, but the ratings have fallen.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, was that, in hindsight, a mistake? Was doing these reveals on the web but then not following them up quickly through the show a mistake?
Damon Carlton.
There are sort of two parts to that question I want to address. First, the issue of the falling ratings. I mean, I think that that's become the story, and it's become a thing that journalists have latched onto. But the truth is,
12 million plus now from that 20.
Well, there was a huge, I think, spike at the beginning of year two, and when we went into the hatch and the show was, we had just won the Emmy and we were in the popular zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. And legitimately, there's a decline from there. But the ongoing decline is actually significantly less than what's measured by Nielsen. And because I think Lost is groundbreaking in many ways, one of the ways it's groundbreaking is that people are watching television in different measures. We have actually been shown numbers by ABC, which are called the Live Plus 7 numbers, which basically is the total Nielsen audience plus the number of people that are TiVoing the show and watching it within the next 7 days.
So Nielsen's getting it for that 12, but you're saying there are a lot more TiVo and...
TiVo
and downloads,
and streaming. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are literally several million people who watch the show on ABC.com every week and stream it onto their computers. And so, when you aggregate that audience, in fact, the erosion is, very I think around 10% or 9% or something like that. It's a lot less,
but much stronger. And you might even be arguing they're kind of the audience of the future, the audience that gets it all kinds of ways.
Absolutely.
Sure. And to answer the second part of the question, the internet experience was something that we cooked up for exactly the hardcore fans, the Losties who kind of wanted those mythological answers. And because we knew that we probably wouldn't find a generic, an acceptable way to do it on the show, because the reality is that Jack and Kate and Claire and Charlie don't care about the numbers.
Or who Alvar Hanzo is.
Or who Alvar Hanzo is.
That is, your characters don't care about the numbers.
Right. And if they don't
your
care about it,
do,
they're...
Though.
Yeah, they're not pursuing those answers. But the audience does care, and the audience does deserve to have those answers. So we tried to find a format to present those answers to the audience who cared. But a large portion of our audience, say my mother in New Jersey, doesn't even know who Alvar Hanzo is. He is a name that is mentioned once in an orientation film in a hatch to her. So.
But you end up with two tracks there or more, depending on the degree of commitment here? And does that complicate, writing her on the story?
Well, it's intentional, and I think it's basically a way, again, in an evolving media, climate to take advantage of new platforms. And so for us, the internet was a way, this alternate reality game was a way to give the hardcore fans more mythological answers, as Damon said, answers that we weren't going to tell on the show. Because if you look at it, if Kate says to Jack, here's all a bunch of stuff I found out about Alvar Hanzo and his company and his foundation, it doesn't really impact those characters' lives. It doesn't have any effect on how those characters are going to interact with each other. So we thought, well, in most shows or in the most traditional shows, that material all sort of stays under the waterline. But here, because we have the internet and we have all these new platforms, we knew that mythology. So we thought, well, here's a way for us to put it out there for the fans like Chris who wanted to know it.
You've got room for the biggest appendix in history right there. Let's take a call from Bill in Boston. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. You're the best at what you do. And I think these guys are doing pretty well with what they do as well.
I'd say so. What's your question, Bill?
My question is regarding casting, I guess. I'm just wondering, the characters are so well developed. And I know from week to week, it's probably, like you said, a pretty complicated deciding the storyline for the week and, which character is going to be focused on, which I think is, part of the interesting part of the show is just the amazing character development and storyline. How does one go about choosing the initial characters for the show and then trying to fit the storyline to those characters as, as we develop from week to week? That was my question.
Yeah, Bill, great. Thanks. Damon?
That's a great question, Bill. And I think, we continue to follow the same model that we sort of set, the JJ and I and the other executive producer of the show, Brian Burke, sort of set when we cast the pilot, which is, we had an idea for these characters. There's going to be a doctor. He's the hero. There's going to be a woman who turns out to be a fugitive. There's going to be a Han Solo type con man. But then when the actors would come in, we started, you know, writing the characters more around the actors who excited us and completely sort of changed our idea of them. So it was more like making a custom suit. You know, the character of Sawyer, for example, was supposed to be a very slick sort of, you know, Prada suit wearing con man.
And this is sort of the bad boy con man,
Exactly. But then Josh Holloway came in and this guy's from Georgia and he's kind of got an entirely different kind of vibe going on about him. So we kept the con man idea, but sort of made him a cowboy. And Yoon-jin Kim, who plays Sun on the show so brilliantly, she's an actress who came in and read for Kate and was so great that we basically said, we should have a Korean couple on the show. You know, it would be great if you know, she secretly spoke English, but he didn't know that. And so in some cases, the casting process itself actually began to inform the story as opposed to the other way around.
And this season, the word is more character development as opposed to everything else that went on. Carlton, was that because you needed to kind of strum a different tune here for a while to mix it up?
Well, I think, again, you know, we're one of the reasons that we're interested in defining an end date is it's a little bit hard to make the show not knowing exactly how long the remaining mythology has to play out. So we also felt at this point that, like, you know, this was a good time for us to dig into some of these characters and to introduce introduce the others in a little bit more complete fashion. You know, some people, I think particularly, it was probably a mistake for us to have six episodes on in the fall, which were focused too much on our characters in captivity and on the others.
Love story, love triangle, Whoopi in a cage, off we went.
Isn't that the title of your autobiography, Carlton, Whoopi in a Cage?
It is, yes,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I think that because there were just those six episodes, people felt like, well, wait, is Lost changed into something else? Has it become a brand new show? I think now that we're going to put episode 14 on tonight, and by the time you look at the season in its totality, you know, you'll feel like there's a balance, and then we're getting back to the characters that we know and love, and you know, that when you see season 3 in its totality, I think you will feel like the first six episodes had a real reason to exist and be the types of stories that they were.
Are you absolutely sure it's going to end? You said somewhere that the owners, you know, could decide not to. ABC, Touchstone could take it on. If they did, you wouldn't go with it. Are you guaranteed it will end, or might the suits come in and say, no, boys, we're going on with this?
We, you know, there are no guarantees in life, but we have a tremendous amount of confidence that, you know, that the suits, and actually, that's actually a surprising, you know, analogy, which is that these guys don't even wear suits anymore. Our boss, you know, wears jeans and a button-down shirt. And I think that is actually reflective of the way, you know, that they have begun to sort of deal with, you know, creatives.
We're talking this hour about TV's big drama of island castaways and some crazy karma out there. It's Lost. You know it. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse are with us, executive producers of the show. And, of course, it's got its Emmys and its Golden Globe. Here's a clip with Hurley, the big guy, curly-haired big guy played by Jorge Garcia. He spent time building a golf course on the island. He thinks the crash survivor should have some fun. And here, other characters, Michael, Charlie, Jack, they confront Hurley on that.
This is what you've been wasting your time on?
Dudes, listen. Our lives suck. Everyone's nerves are stretched to the max. I mean, we're lost on an island, running from boars and monsters. Freaking polar bears.
Polar bears?
You didn't hear about the polar bear?
Look, all I'm saying is, if we're stuck here, then just surviving's not going to cut it. We need some kind of relief, you know? We need some way that we can, you know, have fun. That's right, fun. Or else we're just going to go crazy waiting for the next bad thing to happen.
Hurley looking for some relief on Lost. Executive producers Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse are with us. Brian's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Brian, you're on the air. Hello, Brian. Are you there? Ooh, Brian's lost. Let's get another from Mystic, Connecticut. French, are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And thanks to your guests for the great show. It is the quintessential water cooler show, and please take that as the ultimate compliment.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
I have two quick questions. The first is, for those of us who are looking for explanation in the goings on the island, can we look to the orientation episode, specifically the orientation film where the presenter presents to the viewers, you know, what the Donald Initiative is all about.
And we should say this is the piece just put together recently for people who may not have been in the Lost stream all the way through that brings them up to date so they can jump in. And you're looking for clues there too, French?
Yes. I think specifically he mentions like five or six different areas that they are studying. I think he specifically mentions zoological studies, paranormal psychology,
okay.
electromagnetism,
okay.
and utopian society. And then the second question is there any possibility to the rumor that when the show starts to wind down and it nears its end, that the answers or the end will be revealed in a film and not on television, but as a movie?
French, we've got it. Carlton, Damon?
The first part first, which is, you know, the orientation film that I think French is referring to is one of the, you know, there are these movies made sort of in the early 80s by this by the Dharma Initiative, who were built all these hatches and stations on the island.
These are the others, not the survivors, but the sort of creepy, inexplicable others who are there.
Correct.
Something.
Mm-hmm. And they don't refer to themselves as the others because they're just, yeah. you know, but that's how we refer to them because they were there first. But basically, this Dharma Initiative, we're going to be learning a lot more about them, exactly what they were doing there, what experiments they were doing in various stations. And you'll be getting that information by the end of season three, French. As to the movie,
I.e. this season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Now, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk and rumors about the movie, but really, honestly, we've had no conversations about it. We feel like television is the best form for the show and that our hope is that the show will end on television. Just to finish, there is a little bit of a distinction between the Dharma and the others, and that was hinted at in an episode a couple of weeks ago. And the fact is that the Dharma Initiative was a group of people that came to this island and set up these research facilities. But there were
with Project Unknown, at least to us now. Yeah.
Yes, and there were others. There were people there that predated the Dharma Initiative, and the interrelationship between the others and the Dharma Initiative will become clearer. And really, that's kind of what this season is about: is trying to answer some of the questions about the others and the people who were on the island before our guys. And while those mysteries won't be completely wrapped up, we do hope that the audience will feel some sense of conclusion at the end of the season, sort of like a Harry Potter book. I mean, it doesn't wrap up the entire story, but each book does wrap up a specific story within that world.
And what about your orientation video? French may be sitting there watching it again and again on his PC looking for clues there. Can you put his mind to rest on that? Should he hit replay again and again?
No, probably not.
No. Well, look, sometimes we actually, you know, we have taken this idea that, you know, sort of only previously occurred in DVDs and hidden Easter eggs in the show. You know, we have trained our audience to look very closely, and we do that. And of course, sometimes when you announce that there is an Easter egg hunt, the kids actually find things that you did not hide, rocks that look like Easter eggs.
Right, right. Don't eat that.
Yes, exactly. And that happens sometimes too. But in the case of the orientation videos, we very meticulously figure out what every shot and every piece of audio and every jump cut is going to be in those things so that the information that gets disseminated is not, you know, confusing, but it is more sort of mystifying and alluring.
Yeah, and there are certain clues, like Marvin Candle doesn't have a real hand, and that's a clue.
There's really no way to talk about this film without appearing to be completely insane.
Yeah, I know.
That's out
Trust
there.
Us, it makes more sense when you see it.
You know, the fandom and the following has been so fierce on this, even to the point, and I want to bring in a couple of folks who want to speak with you. At Tufts University, here in our backyard, they're teaching a course on Lost in the Experimental College there. It's titled The Future is Lost, a TV series as cultural phenomenon. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, I want to bring in a couple of the students involved with that, if I may.
Please, we've heard about these guys.
Here it is. Chadwick Matlin is with us. He's a senior there, majoring in anthropology, co-teaches the course. He's an intern here at our station. Chadwick, great to have you.
Good to have
you. And Sarah Rappaport, also a senior at Tufts, Middle Eastern Studies. Middle Eastern Studies, Lost, I don't know. She's also enrolled in this course. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, Sarah, first to you, you've taken the course. You want to spend a semester thinking about Lost? What made it worth it for you?
I would think as an average viewer, I wasn't participating in the, you know, online community. I wasn't even aware of the Lost experience prior to this course. And so what's made it worth it is learning about all of the, you know, you mentioned the Easter eggs. We talk about every week, we talk about the things that might have been hidden in each episode, learning about the different influences on the core, on the show, just sort of a more depth that I would have gained just watching the show regularly.
Your course tying it back to Heart of Darkness and Gilgamesh and Watership Down and you name it. Chadwick, you've got a co-creator here, the executive producers. You're teaching this, but you must have questions. I mean, okay, you've got a course going on. Here are the guys. What's your question, Professor Matlin?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there are dozens of questions. I guess a key one. What some of the class has been complaining about every now and then.
Yeah.
Have they been complaining about us mocking them in the podcast?
Well, that yes, that was brought up in class. Now,
we have not gotten full tenure yet.
It's not mocking. It's acknowledging.
Good-natured fun. Yeah, right.
But some of the classes worry that the characters don't talk enough to each other and that they don't communicate, maybe not about the mythology of the island, but just about things that are going on in their lives. And there doesn't seem to be, and that leads to some of the miscommunications. And I guess the question is whether that's sort of a device to advance the plot or whether that's how
that's an interesting question. Why do you care? I mean, because it's like a family and you're saying, oh, there's bad communication in this family, or because for you it hurts the narrative thread, or you just wish they'd talk to each other and figure it out so the suspense would break? Why?
Well, I think it's an issue of the show becoming a part of our reality as viewers and a part of something that we think about on Thursday mornings when, as one of the Collins said, we talk about around the water cooler, and we want to try and make sense of these characters to the point where we're applying our normal rational logic onto their lives, even though they're
fictional. Ooh, that's interesting. So two things. Why don't the characters talk to each other, and should viewers come to it with the expectation that we'll fit into the framework of normal, rational lives? Executive producers.
I think that we think that the characters do talk to each other to the degree that we want them to, but like everybody else in the world, they're dysfunctional, and I think that, you know, we all struggle with our relationships with each other, and if our characters all kind of perfectly got along or were perfectly communicative, there wouldn't be any drama between them. As far as the mythology goes, we very intentionally have the characters rarely talk about the mythology with each other, and I think that is one of the reasons that the show is not a cult hit but is a broader-based hit. I think that when you have characters focusing on just the mythology, then the entire narrative focus and everyone's interest really becomes only in those mythological questions, and by having the characters really not focus on that and focus really on sort of character attributes, it allows the show to be appreciated on a level independent of the mythology.
And I think, you know, what frustrates, understandably, Chadwick and his class and a large part of our audience is this idea of that a lot of the things that they should be talking about are common sense. I mean, the reality is if they would just sort of sit by the campfire every night and do sort of a recap of their day, that they would avoid a lot of, you know,
problems.
A lot of moronic problems. And, you know, and I think that clip that you just played where Hurley is basically talking about the golf course and they say the polar bear and Michael goes, there's a polar bear? Well, you know, you would think that when they saw the polar bear that they would come back and announce it to all 40 castaways.
Yes,
this is
would.
A rather significant discovery.
On the South Pacific Island,
Sure, we started writing those scenes actually in season one, and some of them we actually shot, and they were like
so boring.
The most boring thing ever, because it was like the audience already saw it. So it's like, unless there is an emotional reaction to hearing there's a polar bear,
right.
You know, because the obvious follow up the obvious follow up question is, well, where do you think it came from? And I don't know. So then they become you at the water cooler. So we'd rather have the audience be frustrated than bored.
Yeah,
so,
and it just all, you know, you have those scenes, you know, those expositional scenes, we actually carefully dodge those things at all costs. I mean, because once the audience knows the information, we want to kind of create a narrative situation where we don't have to have the characters exchanging information that the people on the show already know.
No time for recap. We've got a universe to figure out. Sarah, what do you want from this show? Do you want to be mystified or educated in philosophy or just enthralled? What do you find yourself wanting?
I think I would have to go with the enthralled. Every week I wait for the show, and right after I call my friends and chat with them about it, and I'm not looking to learn about philosophy, although it's interesting how you tie literary elements and philosophy and all these things into the show, and I think that's great. But I think overall I'm just captivated by, you know, the different aspects of the show, the science fiction end, the mystery end, the drama, all of those, the character relations, all of those things.
And a good old-fashioned story in a whole new realm.
And yeah.
It's too bad that's all going to end with the Nikki and Paolo episode.
Uh-oh.
Which we're looking forward to.
Okay. Hold the reveal.
Lord help
us. I'm glad there's one person who is.
Right. Sarah Rappaport and Chadwick Matlin, they're at Tufts University studying Lost in The Future is Lost. Chad, Sarah, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Let's take a call from Lexington, Massachusetts. Lex is on the air. Hi, Lex.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi. What do you know? What do you think?
Well, I got started watching Lost because my husband is a classmate, an old classmate of Damon's from Teaneck, New Jersey.
No kidding.
And we went to the video store and got an old DVD to check it out, and now, of course, we're completely hooked. We're big fans. And I just wanted, I had a question about the cultural diversity on the show, on the, of the cast. And
you've got the Korean couple, you've got Saeed, a former member of the Iraqi Republican Guard, and right on. What about it, Lex?
Well, you know, Teaneck is in Bergen County, which is an incredibly culturally diverse part of our country. And so I'm wondering if your childhood in Teaneck influenced your desire to create such a wonderful mixture of characters.
Oh, Damon, are they know you from childhood.
Are you really calling from Lexington, Massachusetts, or are you calling from the Teaneck Board of Tourism?
Right.
There we go.
First off, I'm dying to know who your husband was. But
say the name, Lex, if you like. You're free.
Kyle Johnson.
Oh, I know Kyle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kyle actually graduated a year ahead of me. So
you pull out the yearbook tonight. And what about that diversity?
Basically, you know, we had this opportunity when we were casting Lost that basically it was a show that for the first time in a long time was not going to be set in the United States of America.
Mm.
Most of our shows here, you know, hospital shows, lawyer shows, cop shows, mm-hmm. you know, we're all based in the States. We were actually, you know, this island is in the South Pacific. So, yes, it is a plane that is flying to Los Angeles. But basically you could put anybody on it who would be in Australia flying to L.A., you know, to somewhere else. So it gave us the opportunity to, you know, to basically cast every character, you know, non-specific culturally. So we brought in African-American actors to read for Jack and Sawyer. We brought in Asian, you know, actors to read for Kate. We brought in, you know, Latino actors to read for, you know, for Hurley and so on and so forth. So we weren't like Jack is a white doctor. Sawyer is a white con man.
Yep.
You know, Son is a Korean woman. Mm. We basically had just these ideas, a father and son, and then Harold Perrineau, J.J. saw him in a play, and we're basically like, we want that guy. So the reality was, the result of it was, you know, an incredibly multi-ethnic cast, but not just in the way that you normally see on television where there are black faces and white faces and Asian faces. There were actually, you know, Iraqi characters and Korean characters and Australian characters. So, you know, that was very exciting for us and is something that, you know, that has sort of continued through the show in terms of bringing on characters like Mr. Echo, who is actually Nigerian, and Adewale, the actor, is a Nigerian. So, you know, that's been very exciting and liberating for us as storytellers.
Think with us for a minute here. We just got a couple about where this show points. If this is the future, as the college class there title might have it, as executive producers, what have you learned? What do you think points forward powerfully from this show? You know, what seeds that you've grown up here do you think are going to thrive that are different from what's been done on TV in the past? And what might Lost leave behind as baggage learned and done?
You know, hopefully, I mean, it's hard, of course, to prognosticate about the future and especially about your own show. But I think that obviously the type of storytelling that we've done on Lost has already had influence on television. I mean, a show like Heroes, I think, only exists because of Lost's success. And I think that the multi-platform applications of Lost, the fact that there is this active internet community and people who are, you know, interested in going and playing the internet experience, and ultimately, you know, there's going to be little miniature episodes of Lost that are going to be available on your mobile phones. This kind of total change from a show being a show to a show being a brand, and having different applications of storytelling being told across varied media platforms, I think people will look back and say, well, Lost was sort of the first show that started that, and that will become a new paradigm. You know, shows will start on a network, but then there will be all these sort of ancillary creative products that will be in other media platforms that will arise from that.
Sprawling all over. And Damon, we've just got a few seconds. You say you know how it's going to end. Going to end neat? Going to end messy?
Both, I think, is the most honest answer. I think that at the end, hopefully the audience will have all the answers that they crave. But I think when all great things come to an end, whether it be the seventh Harry Potter book or the ending of The Stand, you look back on it and say the journey was so satisfying that the ending kind of didn't quite measure up to it, and you know, and I almost wish it had been canceled at the end of its first season.
Right. Well, we guess that's not you talking. Good luck bringing it home, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, executive producers of Lost. It's been great having you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having us, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.